No surprise here, but you know I gotta have my devices when I travel. I would be lost without my smartphone. I use it for directions, to find things to do, and most importantly, where to eat. I rely on it as a digital music player to enhance my experience as I explore a new place. Oh, and sometimes I even use it to make calls and stuff. That's the kind of traveler I am. And if you travel, you know what kind you are, too. That's why you go with the Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card. If you travel, you know. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I'm an editor. And sitting in front of me, as usual, is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
Gee, I'm really sorry your mom blew up, Ricky.
I'm sorry, I wasn't expecting that one.
Yeah, that one has nothing to do with what we're talking about.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's a great movie, isn't it?
Yes,
if you have not seen that movie, then you need to find out what that quote is from and then go see that movie.
Raisins.
he likes corn. We could just quote that movie for the rest of the podcast, but that
would be fine. It wouldn't
cover the topic that the title says.
True, and it is one of our favorite gaming companies that we're talking about the history of today. Sega.
Yes. Chris was the one who came up with the brilliant title, The Sega Saga.
Yes.
It's an epic Sega saga. So let's
and it has nothing to do with Iceland.
Right.
It's a completely different saga.
No. There's no Beowulf in the... Well, they might have made a Beowulf game. I didn't go through their entire arcade library. Anyway.
And then it was disgruntled. Anyway.
Nice. Oh, man. You can tell we've already done one podcast this morning because we're really warmed up now.
A little loopy. So the funny thing is, Sega still exists.
Right.
So we are not burying a company as we did with Midway.
Right.
So much. But it exists in a radically different form than it did many years ago. And many people, and I had no idea when I started the research for this, but many people think of Sega as another one of those Japanese arcade game companies or
like
game
Nintendo.
Companies like Nintendo or Taito or...
Or Sony.
Sony and some of the others. Not so much.
No.
It is. But
it began as an American company.
Yes.
In Honolulu, Hawaii.
Which I guess technically in 1940, Honolulu still was not in an American. It was an American territory.
That's true. It wasn't a state.
And I think you'd probably still call it an American company. And its name comes from Standard Games.
Actually, it comes from the second name. Standard Games was their original name.
Yes.
But
oh,
they
yes.
then changed
service
to Service Games.
Sorry.
Yeah. Because they took the SE from service and the GA from games and became Sega. Now, why was it called Service Games? Because early on in its history, the company made coin-operated amusements.
Yes.
Right? So these are the kind of old-style penny arcade-type games.
Mm-hmm.
And they made them specifically. They were making them for a very niche market.
Niche.
Military bases.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's where you got the name Service Games.
Aha. Because they were in the service.
Exactly. And they... The company had been around for a few years when they kind of got this idea of relocating to Japan.
Yes. The company originally, as Standard Games, was founded by Martin Bromley, Irving Bromberg, and James Humpert. And they started it in 1940.
Right.
Oddly enough, right before the United States entered World War II.
Right.
With Japan, of course. And in 1950...
After an event that happened in Hawaii.
Yes. But in 1951, Bromley was the one that said, let's move to Tokyo. And that actually, you might say, why did you bring that up right after the war thing? It actually had a lot to do with the war.
Mm-hmm.
Not just because they were originally creating games for service locations, but also because Japan had been damaged pretty heavily in the last days of the war, pretty heavily, very heavily. And the country was rebuilding, and they saw an opportunity to get in on the ground floor of and create an industry that really didn't exist in Japan like it did in the United States. In the United States, they had competition from other game manufacturers, where in Japan, they would have a much more open market.
Yeah, this was really amazing foresight, right? Because you have to remember, at this time in history, no one was really looking to Japan to become a leader in electronics or any of those kind of industries. I mean, Japan was a country that had been devastated by war.
Yes.
And the United States, of course, invested quite heavily in rebuilding Japan, as did other nations.
Yes.
And Japan, for its part, didn't just accept money and coast. The Japanese people, the Japanese government, really dedicated themselves to building a new Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, did they. The electronics industry alone became so important to Japan, and they became so innovative that Japan, you could argue, became the leader in several electronics subcategories.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where you had countries like America say, wow, what happened? We were way in the lead there. How did that happen? And the reason it happened was companies like Sega really saw the opportunity and seized it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So in 1965, Sega merged with another company, Rosen Enterprises.
Right.
Again, founded by an American, David Rosen, in 1954. And that company had been working on instant photo booths and mechanical arcade games.
Yeah.
I think of that being sort of like pinball machines and those things with the cranes that never seem to work.
The claw.
Yes, yeah. The claw.
Or the games where you get the coins that are right there on the edge, and all it's going to take is one more coin, and it'll knock all those coins in, you'll be rich, but somehow, despite the laws of gravity and the conservation of energy, it just doesn't work, which shows you that science is a lie. Okay, that last part was a joke.
I'm going to send in the... stuff to blow your mind, staff, and they can have a talk with you about that.
Explain how this is scientifically possible. I dare you.
But it wasn't long after that Sega released its first major hit, at least that I saw referenced, and that's called Periscope. It's a submarine simulator, again with the war theme.
Yeah.
In 1969, I'm giving you the concise history here, which is the one that's on the Sega website. In 69, Sega, Rosen and the other people who were shareholders in Sega decided to sell out to Gulf and Western, which, according to Britannica, was founded in 1958, and just became it was a huge conglomerate company. It owned Paramount Pictures, and then it changed its name, Gulf and Western. I remember seeing that on the Paramount logo and wondering what the connection was. Well, it changed its name to Paramount Communications. In 1989, and then Viacom gobbled it up in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
But that's you know, sort of how it became a worldwide entity, because first it had the hit with Periscope, and then it was, you know, became part of a very large media distribution company.
Right. And I thought it was interesting that this is just kind of an aside. I don't really have a whole lot of detail about this, but that in the 70s, Sega really kind of tried to branch out beyond just doing the amusements and the games.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And created its own Sega-branded television.
Really?
Large screen TV, yeah, in the 70s.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, it's one of those just odd things. Obviously, it was not ended up not being the direction the company moved in, but mm-hmm. it was something that they were trying out different things. And as the arcade game began to evolve, you know, late 70s, that's when we started seeing arcade games appear. As it began to evolve, Sega got involved in that because, you know, that was sort of Sega's thing, was they were all about coin-operated amusements. And then after the coin-operated games started to really take off, that's when you started to see companies develop the home game consoles.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, I have to say that as I was doing research for this, I started, of course, with Sega, but ended up on a really awesome, lengthy history of Sega at IGN, done by Travis Foss, F-A-H-S, and he really gets into a lot of depth about the company.
Mm-hmm.
According to his article, it was Space Invaders release in 1978 by Taito,
mm-hmm.
Causing a coin shortage in Japan.
Wow.
That helped spur the video game industry in Japan. And Sega at that point picked up an American company called Gremlin Industries to come up with ideas for arcade games.
Did they feed them after midnight?
It's always midnight somewhere, as
that's
you
true.
Pointed out.
That's true.
Well, not always, but at the top of the hour.
Yeah.
And Head On was the result of that.
Applied directly to forehead?
It was a maze game. Amazing. No. Not completely dissimilar to another famous maze game not created by Sega.
Pac-Man?
Yes.
Yeah.
But I remember some of the games that Mr. Foss mentions in his article, including Zaxxon, which was a 3D space shooter.
That was a great game.
I loved Zaxxon.
Fantastic game.
And he also mentioned Buck Rogers Planet of Zoom, which I can't remember if it was in the corner pizza place where I used to spend all my parents' quarters.
Yeah. For me, it was Skate Country.
But
was the name of the skating rink at my hometown.
Oh, this was That's a Pizza.
There's some free plugs for businesses that no longer exist.
Yeah. But as Jonathan mentioned, they started getting into home games with some... They started out with a very, very, very ugly console named the SG-1000.
Yeah, now this was marketed only in Japan.
Yes.
It did not get worldwide distribution, and it's probably a good thing. It came out around 1983,
mm-hmm.
and it was a cartridge-based system, right?
Yep, that was during the game crash that we talked about in an earlier podcast.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, because it came out, I would say that was the second wave of home... Big wave of home consoles.
Yeah,
really.
Sega had some amazing timing with its console releases. The first being that releasing a console shortly after the massive home gaming crash that happened. If you remember from our podcast about that crash, what happened was that the market became glutted mm-hmm. with various consoles and games, many of which were of a poor quality, and so. The home market enthusiasts became disenchanted with video games in general. And a lot of people were making the move toward looking at personal computers, which really had not hit big time by 1983 yet, but were starting to gain a lot of traction. So home consoles were hurting at this time. Now, this console that Sega released, the SG-1000, it had some problems. it only had a RF connection. So
yeah.
If you were to buy one today, you would actually have to probably find an adapter in order to play it.
I have one.
An RF adapter?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Somewhere in a box.
Or you have an SG-1000.
No, I don't have an SG-1000. You know, they were pretty affordable. They only cost 15,000 yen, which, you know, was about $130 $5, according to I didn't do the pricing for today. I can look it up on.
No, that's all right. I didn't do that. I got messages last time about how irritating it was for me to do the full conversion.
But it did launch on July 15th, 1983, at the same day as, do you know?
Was it the Fancom?
Yes, the Famicom.
Yeah.
Which was known to those of us in the United States as the Nintendo Entertainment System,
the NES.
So yes, right out of the gate, Sega released this on the same day as an icon in the video game industry.
Now, of course, the Nintendo Entertainment System would make its way to the United States a little later.
Yes, but the SG-1000 never
does
did.
Not. And let me tell a little
have
bit more.
16 colors.
Yeah, I'll give you a little more detail about this console. It also had a hardwired, permanently attached joystick.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't a joystick that you would unplug and pack up. The reason for that was that it made it less expensive to produce.
Right.
But apparently, the joystick had problems. It had poor response time. You had to really press on it to get things done. And it was rectangular, kind of like the shape of a remote control, with a joystick toward the top end in the center and buttons on either side.
Mm-hmm.
Not the most comfortable thing in the world to hold. I actually read an article in Wired where one of the Wired writers found one while attending a game conference in Japan and purchased it for about $58 to bring it back and try it out, because hardly anyone bought this thing. The Nintendo beat the pants off of it in Japan, and of course, it never saw worldwide distribution.
Yes.
So his review was that you could see why it never saw worldwide distribution. The games, he said, were pretty much not that great, and the controls were really difficult, and the Nintendo was just a superior system.
Yep. And in fact, it scared away the corporate parent. Now, lest you have paused the podcast and corrected me on Viacom owning Sega, in 1982, Gulf and Western, before Paramount even entered the picture, before they changed their name, they said, okay, no, Mr. Rosen, you want your company back?
Yeah.
They were asking $38 million for Sega, which, you know, I would have considered a bargain in today's terms probably.
But, right.
So basically, David Rosen found some other willing partners, and including a company named CSK Holdings, a Japanese company. Basically, they bought it back from Gulf and Western, headquartered in Japan, and Rosen stayed in Los Angeles, California, to manage the United States operation. The SG-1000, not a hit, and Gulf and Western says, no, you go ahead. You can have it back.
And a couple of years later, Sega launches a new console, the Sega Master System.
Oh, so we're skipping the SG-1000...
Two. Yeah, I'm skipping all the twos. Several of the consoles we'll be talking about had follow-up consoles.
And
that
the Sega Mark III?
Yeah. Let's just talk about the ones that are important.
It's funny if you go back to the list of if you go find this article and find these boxes.
Yeah.
They are the most depressing looking beige chunks of plastic.
Kind of reflects their eventual fate.
Yes. However, but not their eventual successes, which looked far cooler.
So
the Master System.
The Sega Master System, yeah. It came out in Japan around 1985, mm-hmm. and then it got worldwide release the next year. And that was another 8-bit-based video game console system. So this is the same general processing level as the Nintendo Entertainment System.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 32 color system as opposed to the 16 from the previous console. And again, cartridge based, but it also had a slot for a card system. The cards would actually hold games that were not as complicated, that didn't need the full capacity that a cartridge could hold.
Well, you could like walk around with a whole pocket full of games and trade them with your friends, right?
These would be it's like Pog. No, these were the you could play Pog with the cards if you really wanted to. Now the cards were for the games that were much less complicated. So you might have your A title games, those would all be on cartridges because they needed that space. But then you would have these very simple games that were not demanding as far as storage space goes. And so those would be used on the cards. The card thing did not last very long. The later versions of the Sega Master System just did away with it because hardly anyone was purchasing these card games. And then they would release like batches of these card games all contained to one cartridge instead.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of like if you've ever played a more modern console where they release the classic games where you'll get like maybe 30 or 40 classic games on one disc. It was kind of the equivalent to that.
Mm-hmm.
And that one was around $200 when it launched.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, at this point, I believe a man named Hayao Nakayama was in charge of Sega in Japan, and Rosen was handling things here in the United States. They didn't always so much
see eye to eye,
get along.
Yeah.
And that's important because that story is going on behind the scenes here.
Right.
We don't really see that. Those of us who are Sega fans, we don't really see all that stuff because, you know, this is not the kind of thing where, you know, you would typically know about that. What you're looking at is, you know, whether or not Space Harrier and Outrun and Zaxxon are coming to your house.
Right.
But the thing is that the decisions made by Sega in Japan and Sega in America had a great deal to do with the successes and failures of the company, as we're going to see coming up shortly.
Yeah.
Because at this point, this is when Nintendo is launching Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah.
Around that time.
The Sega Master System was seeing some success in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
They were actually selling fairly well in Europe. But in the United States and Japan, they were trailing sales of the NES.
Yeah.
And I mean, the Sega's strong suit at this point was their intellectual property for their arcade games, like you were saying.
Right.
Like
and
they had that leverage.
And Nintendo had Mario.
Right. Nintendo had an identifiable mascot.
Yes.
Right?
And Sega needed something like that.
Yeah, because, I mean, you could say that Atari had Pac-Man.
True, yeah. Atari had licensed Pac-Man from Namco.
Right.
For use
for
in
better
home.
Or for worse.
That was another podcast.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's... they were really looking for some character that they could use, they could leverage. And I know who you're thinking of, but it wasn't him yet.
No, no.
It was Alex Kidd that they settled on.
Yeah.
If you haven't heard of him...
That shows that it was not a huge success.
Right. No, they tried to make him into a franchisable character that they could parlay at home, but he just didn't... Alex Kidd in Miracle World just didn't take off like they hoped it would.
Well, who would have thought that Jumpman would eventually become an iconic character?
You mean a shortish plumber in overalls with
yeah,
a bushy mustache?
Yeah, I mean, Mario started off as Jumpman. No one would have thought this guy is going to become the icon for a company.
Yeah, yeah.
And he did. Showed us. So at this time, we're getting into the late 80s. Sega starts to plan its next big console.
Yes. How do you follow up a console named the Master System?
Especially one that didn't do so well in the United States and Japan. Well, you could call it the Mega Drive if you wanted to.
But why would you do that?
Well, it did do that for some countries. But yes. In the United States, it was called Genesis.
Yes.
Kirk.
Not that Genesis.
What?
It
you
was
mean this thing didn't like make dead planets turn alive?
No.
I'm glad I never bought one then.
The Master System had changed from that really boring beige color to black.
Right.
But it still looked like a box with ports on it.
Yes.
The Genesis was black and shiny and...
sought by Khan.
Roundish. It had curves and it was a lot cooler looking than its previous. Not that that sells. However, Altered Beast being packaged with the system...
Yes.
That helps.
Yeah, now keep in mind the Sega Genesis was still a cartridge-based system. We haven't moved away from cartridges yet.
No.
But it was superior to the NES. It was a 16-bit system.
Yes, it was.
And the NES was an 8-bit system. And when it came out in 1988 in Japan, that was before the Super Nintendo.
Yes.
Not a whole lot longer before the Super Nintendo, but long enough so that Sega had a jump on the 16-bit market.
Yes. Now, the IGN article points out that it didn't take off right out of the gate in Japan. Maybe partially due to, and I didn't know this either, that Super Mario Bros. 3 had been released the week before. Great timing, Sega!
Yeah.
So everybody was still kind of invested in
Nintendo
that
had
game.
Amazing market penetration, too.
Oh, yeah.
So you get to a point, it's just like,
to
jump over to another company for a second, PlayStation had such a great depth of games that the original PlayStation was going strong well after the PlayStation 2 came out. And then when the PlayStation 3 came out, the PlayStation 2 did the same thing. In fact, they were still making PlayStation 2 games long after the PS3 came out.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a level of loyalty among gamers. Also, I mean, let's face it, it costs a lot of money to upgrade from one system to another.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are a gamer and you have a console and there's still new games coming out for that console, there's not a whole lot of reason for you to jump ship to another system unless the games are just phenomenally better.
Yeah.
Now, you could argue that the Genesis games were at least phenomenally better from a graphical standpoint or even sound effects standpoint. The specs on the Genesis were superior to the NES. But again, the market penetration that Nintendo had, particularly in Japan, was hard to just dismiss.
Yeah, the Genesis only sold 400,000 units in its first year, mm-hmm. which is not, I mean, especially by today's standards where gaming is far more entrenched in the market than it used to be, that's nothing.
Right.
But in the United States, they got a guy named Michael Katz to take over. Basically, they named him president of Sega of America 1 month after the Genesis launched. And the company was really trying to push selling a million systems,
mm-hmm.
which again, in today's standards, seems like
tiny.
But Nintendo had the licensees locked up as well. To use Foz's reference, and I mean, they had contracts with them that were binding that said, you know, if you develop for other systems,
you can't develop for us anymore.
No. Nope.
And because Nintendo had such a huge customer base, everyone wanted to develop for Nintendo. Now, for some of you, this might sound familiar
mm-hmm.
because we're seeing similar things in today's market, not necessarily with the video game consoles, but let's talk about developing apps
mm-hmm.
for various platforms.
Yep.
This might sound very familiar to you.
Yes.
So that's not an old idea. Or rather, it is an old idea. It's not a new idea. So this was around the time where Sega finally did come up with a mascot that actually stuck.
Yes.
It was in 1991.
Okay.
That we saw a certain blue rodent that can move really, really fast. Actually, I don't even know if they're rodents. But
I think they are, but I can look.
No, it's okay.
No,
it's
they,
not important.
Foss actually pointed out that this was the point at which Sega got into the sports genre
uh-huh.
pretty heavily. They got people like Tommy Lasorda, Evander Holyfield, Joe Montana, and you'll probably wince when I mention this, a non-sports person but was big on the Genesis, Michael Jackson.
I would just like to point out that none of those are the blue rodent I had mentioned
earlier. Exactly. But no, I just...
The reason
I remember this is because all my friends who had Genesises...
Genesees.
The Genesees liked the sports games. They
right.
were big on the
oh,
sports
sure,
games.
Oh, sure, sure.
So yeah, they really had gotten that. And they helped out a then struggling company named... You probably never heard of this company. Electronic Arts.
No.
Who helped them...
What were the E something?
Yes. Well, they had the Madden franchise. That was when the Madden franchise was just starting.
Yeah.
But they developed the Joe Montana football game for
uh-huh.
Sega as well. And then on top of it, you're right, that blue hedgehog.
Sonic!
Finally showed up. And he was... this really went into their marketing thing because Sonic was a sassy little guy.
Yeah.
Sort of like Mickey Mouse when he made his debut on the scene.
Yeah, before he got kind of watered down a little bit.
Yeah. So Sonic was, right there. He was, he had
was
an attitude.
He was in your face.
Yeah.
He was the Poochie of video game
the
systems.
Poochie.
But the gameplay really started to sell these consoles because people were looking at how fast Sonic the Hedgehog played, and the graphic quality, the fact that you could have these fast-moving, clean graphics with vibrant colors, that really began to catch the attention of the public, and the Genesis started to actually make better sales. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, right around the same time the Genesis was starting to pick up some steam, the Nintendo company came out with the Super Nintendo Entertainment System.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So once again, just as Genesis is catching a lucky break, Nintendo comes out and fires a massive cannon across the bow.
Well, it probably didn't help that at the time, the graphics capabilities of the Genesis led them to market their marketing slogan, Genesis does what Nintendo don't.
Right. Oh, and we should also point out that Sega had a bright idea to make the Genesis backwards compatible.
Yes.
Now, this was something that becomes very important in consoles later down the line, and some companies, mainly Nintendo, didn't really take it to heart for a really long time. The idea that you would be able to play your old games on your new system. Now, in the case of the Genesis, in order to do it, you had to have an adapter,
mm-hmm.
because the cartridges for the Sega Genesis were a different size than the cartridges for the Sega Master System.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you could get an adapter for your Sega Genesis, and then you could play all your old Sega Master games on your Genesis. Now, granted, that's not going to mean that they're going to look better or play better than they did on the older system.
No.
But it means you'll have access to them.
Yep. Yep, and they recruited a guy named Tom Kalinske from Mattel, who had overseen or worked with the Intellivision.
Yeah.
Your favorite game system. And
that's not my I had one, but it's not my favorite.
They pushed him into the CEO of Sega of America slot, and he made a lot of important decisions. He decided that Sonic should be in the box and not Altered Beast.
Yeah.
So Genesis started shipping with that, and Sega in Japan didn't like the idea. They thought it was a bad idea to include Sonic in the box. And Kalinske, not for the last time, proved that he knew what was going to work and what wasn't. And lo and behold, it sold a lot of units.
Yep. So
welcome to the next level.
Yeah.
Sega!
Let's talk about some of the other stuff that Sega did. They also began to introduce expansions for mm-hmm. the Genesis. So not just the adapter that would allow you to play old games, but some expansions that unfortunately did not see a lot of success.
Mm-hmm.
One was the Mega CD, which was allowing you to play... Because here's the thing. Compact discs could hold a lot more information than a cartridge.
Yes, they can.
So the idea was, how about for these games that are going to be really... pushing the envelope mm-hmm. as far as what the console can do. The console is capable of doing more than what a cartridge-based game can provide. So therefore,
yes.
we need to create a system that will allow a new media to be used, new form of media.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, it was the compact disc. So the Mega CD was produced, and a few games came out, including Sonic CD. And they did all right, but it never really took off. No one really adapted to it. And then there was the 32X.
Yes.
Which was another expansion for the Genesis. Originally, it was going to be an update to the whole Genesis console, but there an argument was made that it should be instead an expansion pack rather than a brand new console.
Right.
And the idea here was that it was going to give you a jump on getting to the 32-bit-based game systems. Keep in mind, the Genesis is a 16-bit system.
Yes, and then Sega was already looking forward to the next system.
The next generation, yeah.
It was planning on calling the Saturn.
This was the big problem with the 32X, right?
Yes.
Because they come out with the expansion pack of the 32X, but they also say that they're working on the next generation console. Well, if you're a developer, a game developer, you might think, well, why should I develop for a game system that's going to be obsolete in just 2 years?
Mm-hmm.
Why should I develop a game for that? Instead, I should be developing for the next generation of video game consoles. So not a lot of content was produced that could take advantage of the 32X, so that's why that was a failed adaptation. But the Saturn came out a little bit later in 1994,
mm-hmm.
and in 95 it hit the U.S., and it started to have a lot of the things that you saw as expansion packs for the Genesis.
Yeah, it's an interesting story that apparently Sega had met with Silicon Graphics back in the day and had a meeting with Jim Clark, who was the chairman of Silicon Graphics, and they were trying to sell Sega this new chipset
mm-hmm.
that would allow them to run new high-powered games. And basically, Sega in Japan was committed to going with the chipset that they had already picked out for it. So even though this system was going to be really, really cool, they had to say no. And they said, well, there's another company up in Seattle that might be interested in that. And so they took it to that company, and it became the chipset for the Nintendo 64.
Yeah.
Painful.
Yeah, so the Saturn had three 32-bit processors, but it came out, and it had a CD-ROM drive.
Yeah.
It had two video processors. I mean, this was a machine that had some decent firepower for the time, right? But here's another problem. It came out very close to the same time that another major player in video game consoles came out, which was the debut of the Sony PlayStation.
Yes, this is another missed opportunity on Sega's part, because Sega had talked to Sony.
Right.
And Sony had talked to Nintendo, both of them, about the possibility of doing some kind of partnership. And Sony basically, and Sega couldn't work out their differences. So the thing is, you know, Sony went out on their own and, you know, delivered a severe beating to both of them.
Right. Yeah, so you've got the Sony PlayStation, which was another CD-based system. You also had the Nintendo 64. At this point, Nintendo was still holding on to the cartridge-based systems.
Mm-hmm.
Although some of my favorite video games of all time were made for the Nintendo 64.
Yes.
GoldenEye, anyone? Or WrestleMania 2000?
Yeah.
Or WWF No Mercy? Oh, man, I love the wrestling games. If you guys are fans of wrestling games, let me know, because I'm always on the lookout for really good wrestling games. So, that honestly, if you know of good ones, let me know. I love them. Anyway, back to the matter at hand. So, you've got the Saturn coming out. It does not do well against the PlayStation. It doesn't
not
even do
all.
Well against the Nintendo 64.
No.
It's in third place.
Sadly, that system, I think, is pretty widely considered a dog.
Which is, it had some interesting features.
And
it actually
like
had a slot, yes. It had a slot for additional memory.
Mm-hmm.
So, some of the games on the Saturn were so advanced that the system didn't have enough RAM to run the game.
Well, okay, you know, Sega developed, we skipped over it, and I can just throw it in there real quick since
yep.
we're running low on time.
Mm-hmm.
Sega developed active 3D glasses years before this.
Yes. Yes.
And they didn't take off.
And the consoles supported 3D playback.
Yep.
They were really ahead of their time in a lot of these developments. So here's another problem. Again, they did not learn the lesson that they should have learned with the release of the 32X, where they said, oh, by the way, we're also working on a 32-bit system.
Mm-hmm.
Just 2 years after the Saturn debuted, they talked about how they were working on the next generation of consoles.
Yep.
So again, you had all these developers say, well, why should I develop for a console that has a 2-year shelf life left, maybe?
Mm-hmm.
And you might be thinking, wow, this is really fast, because, of course, right now we're with Xbox 360, PS3, and the Nintendo Wii, none of which we haven't heard any announcements of any kind of successor to any of those three consoles, and they've been out for much longer than 4 years.
Yep.
So,
yeah, Kalinske got fed up and bolted in 1996.
Yeah.
Said he wasn't going to do it anymore, and they brought in a guy named Bernie Stoller, and he was really, apparently, go get him kind of guy. He's just, you know, let's not even talk about it. Let's just go do it. You know, really, really active person. But he was really pushing for the success of the new system, which went down in game console history. I would argue that it's probably Sega's best loved system, even more so than the Genesis.
Yeah, it didn't sell that well necessarily.
Yeah, but it's got a reputation.
I own one, and I still love this system. Originally called the Katana, it came out as the Sega Dreamcast.
Mm-hmm.
The Dreamcast was I love this video game system. The controls were really responsive. The graphics were amazing. The sound was phenomenal. It had a great video game library. It hit the market in 1999. It had 128-bit graphics. It was way ahead of its competitors as far, again, I mean, that was the story of Sega the whole time, right? Whenever the consoles came out, they tended to be ahead of whatever their competitors were offering on the market at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Had 16 megabytes of memory, which to us today sounds really tiny, but at the time was really significant. And it was it actually had a built-in modem. It was the first video game console to have a built-in modem. 56 kilobits per second modem, but it was the first one to have one. So it was actually designed to allow you to have online mm-hmm. capability and play online games.
Mm-hmm. They had
and have a web browser as well.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I didn't realize they had a
mm-hmm.
web browser.
Yep. Well, it was it what wasn't native. It wasn't hardwired into it. You had to have the disk.
Oh, okay. They did have developers. You know, they had Capcom, Midway, Namco, the usual arcade suspects. They didn't have Electronic Arts, who I think got very frustrated with having to do that. They having to deal with Sega's up and downs.
Yeah, mostly downs.
Mostly downs. So they actually went out and purchased another company to develop sports games. And from what I understand, Virtual Concepts, which was the name of the company, did pretty well with sports games.
Man, Virtua Tennis was amazing. That was one of the games I owned, and
yeah.
it is still own. I still have this console. It was also kind of neat because you could one of the ways you could hook up the console to your system was through coax cable.
Mm-hmm.
So you would actually use coax cable into the Dreamcast and coax cable out from the Dreamcast to your television. So it wasn't using like the composite cables that a lot of other systems were using.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it also meant that I could hook up more video game systems to my television because mm-hmm. it was one less port that would be taken up by the machine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, I understand, too, that this was a very productive time in the company's history for coming up with new franchises. I believe Soul Calibur. This is about the time of Soul Calibur came out.
Soul Calibur, another great game. Oh, I've got that one too. Crazy Taxi, great game.
Exactly. And the thing is, though, that even after the 9999 debut and the big launch, and the great games, it just didn't go.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure why. Maybe it's the marketing strategy of the company. Sega. See, I keep doing that. Game companies that start with S for 200. Sega of Japan and Sega of America did not necessarily agree on marketing strategy or how to bundle things or the kinds of chips should be in the machines.
They had to compete against PlayStation coming out with the PS2 and Microsoft making the debut with the Xbox.
And Microsoft did approach Sega as well with the idea of including Windows CE on the Dreamcast.
Yeah.
And they said no. But why were they so interested in the game market?
Yeah. Well, as
it turns out, they
kind of shot itself in the foot on that one. The let me close off. Let me talk a little bit about something else that you could tell where other companies took some inspiration from Sega. If you look at the old Dreamcast controller,
mm-hmm.
it bears a resemblance to the modern Xbox controllers.
Mm-hmm.
It had the triggers. It had a pretty wide controller form factor. There was an analog joystick on there. It also had a slot for memory cards. In fact, the memory cards had little screens on them.
Mm-hmm.
And you could actually have mini games that would pop up on the screen on your card that would be part of the bigger video game you're playing on the screen. And each game would have its own little individual special graphics that would pop up on your memory card.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I loved that. It was just such a neat thing. It was added value for your games.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, ultimately this system also did not last the test of time. And in January 2001, Sega made the decision to get out of the console market entirely and just concentrate on game development.
Yep, stopped actually producing Dreamcast in March of that year. And they've done pretty well releasing some games since then.
Sure.
Super Monkey Ball, anyone?
Great game.
Yeah, it's a great game. And it's, it's made its way to mobile gaming devices.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't even talk about Sega's mobile gaming devices at all. But, it's available for mobile phones and other things and platforms, I should say. And, yeah, I mean, they're known now as a software developer. They re-merged all their developing strategies into one unit. So it's a much leaner company than it was before. A lot of the Sonic games, even Sega's biggest star, I've heard mixed reviews on the Sega, the Sonic games that have come out in the last few years.
Yeah.
So it's just it sort of reminds us of Sega's glory days without giving us the great speed and action that we've all come to know and love.
Yeah. So if you guys have any Sega stories you want to share, or perhaps there's another game company you would like us to cover. You know, we've talked about Atari. We've talked about Sega.
We have a couple others on the list already, of course.
But. Yeah, we plan. We'll have to do an episode about Sony. We have to do one on Nintendo.
We might have to do one on the Dreamcast itself because we kind of cut that short.
Yeah. It's this podcast has gone really long, but the Dreamcast was a pretty phenomenal system.
Yeah,
if you
really
ever
was.
Do have a chance to maybe pick one up at a used game store and you know it's going to work, go ahead and give it a try. I was really impressed with it. The graphics, of course, don't hold up to PS3 or Xbox 360 quality,
mm-hmm.
but they're pretty impressive, even when you consider what their big competitors were.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle there is TechStuffHSW, or you can shoot us an email. That address is TechStuff@HowStuffWorks.com, and Chris and I will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
No surprise here, but you know I gotta have my devices when I travel. I would be lost without my smartphone. I use it for directions, to find things to do, and most importantly, where to eat. I rely on it as a digital music player to enhance my experience as I explore a new place. Oh, and sometimes I even use it to make calls and stuff. That's the kind of traveler I am. And if you travel, you know what kind you are, too. That's why you go with the Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card. If you travel, you know.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off. Starts Friday and open Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
With dozens of streaming services, box office films, and content to choose from, people are spending over 2.5 years of their lives searching for what to watch. But The Hollywood Reporter brings you THR Charts, one place for you, your family, and friends to find the most watched TV shows and movies every week. THR Charts is a guide to help you spend less time scrolling through platforms so that you can spend more time watching and binging the content everyone is talking about, all supported by data and trusted sources like Nielsen, Comscore, and Paired Analytics. Check out THR Charts on HollywoodReporter.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.